Let's roll.
Blog Talk Radio.
Okay, for some reason, the recording isn't going on, but that's okay. This is Westchester on the Level. My name is Hezzy Harris, and of course we begin every Monday with none other than John Bailey. John Bailey is a White Plains Citizen, a reporter, publisher, and editor. He's already on the line. So good morning, John. What a pleasure to speak to you, as always, on Monday.
Yes, good morning, world.
Well, good morning to you. Well, I'm sorry. I guess people must know that you're the publisher and editor of the White Plains Citizenet Reporter, and WPCNR.com is the best and easiest way of getting to your website. And what was fascinating is that I had read only a few days back that you've made it so much easier for people not only to see the different articles that are being posted on the website, but now you can click onto them, the articles that interest you, and it will take you immediately to that article rather than scrolling through a panoply of articles before you reach what you would want, which is more time consuming. It was kind of you to think about that. I like that. I think it's very good.
Yeah. It was pointed out to me by a longtime friend who pointed out, well, the whole problem is you click on the headlines and nothing shows up.
Uh-huh.
And so I have figured out how to use it. And, of course, WordPress instruction manuals give you no clue. They're horrible.
That's the way I see it. I thought it was my own problem. I thought it was my, you know, the medication I was taking, or that I just couldn't figure it out. I was too stupid. But thank goodness other people had that problem. So you evidently overcame that. I think a lot faster than I do.
For many years. I've been using, they've had me on WordPress for years, and I never realized it. But
Yeah, but
that's the way it
me.
Is. I mean, technology is
yeah.
its own enemy. I mean, it's created
yes, it
by
is.
Techophiles who assume that you know everything that they know and what they mean by a widget or a glodget or a pudget, you know, which is the way WordPress manuals explain the things. And they say, well, type in this long string of programming stuff.
Yeah.
You don't want to do that.
I'm scared to death at times to do what they suggest because I don't know if I'm going to do it right. Or my whole website's going to get blown up.
Absolutely. I mean, the best instruction manuals ever were the ones written by Apple when they first started.
Yes.
Because they treated you as a total visitor from another planet and took you right through the simplest stuff. I got writing with it right away when I got my first computer in 1984.
Same with me.
Moment of silence, the incomparable Apple IIe. And it was the greatest computer for word processing for a person who had ever word processed.
Exactly.
And, yeah, it was also the best computer for games, too. I mean, I used to waste hours because the games were so good. But then they switched off to something else, and then you couldn't play the games you used to play because it was a different system. And the constant way the computer companies change things makes them it's a way to get you more product and buy more.
Yeah.
And typical of American industry, they lost their mojo.
I think you're quite right and quite on target.
Mm.
Well, I want you to cover a couple of issues that you covered
sure.
on your website, particularly the article that was promoted by Greenberg Town Supervisor Paul Feiner. He proposed eclipsing the concept of not in my backyard with a new concept called yes in my backyard. And that was based on the proposal where Governor Hochul of New York said that she wanted to enable New York State to override local zoning if a locality doesn't comply with state quotas. Yet Greenberg, for one, has complied and actually exceeded in building affordable housing to address the New York State severe housing shortage. So Feiner suggested instead that the state should provide financial incentives to taxpayers who live in such communities. I think that was really brilliantly astute of him to recognize
yes.
that. You know, he seems to be so on target. It's absolutely mind-boggling. What a brain.
He is smarter than every politician in New York State because he reasons things out. He makes sense. He does what is good for the people. What a concept.
Wow. Yeah.
And
no wonder he's
yes.
been in
and
office for
they
so
hate
long.
Him for that. They hate
know,
him for that
do.
Because he will not play political ball. They can't defeat him because the people in Greenberg know that he cares about them.
Yeah.
Which is more than many of our representatives here in Westchester do.
Mm.
I mean, I have not heard one peep out of them on this about, and what's fascinating, Hezzy, is we have a county executive who 2 years ago did a huge study on the lack of affordable housing, something like 11,000 new units were needed, and here Hochul
mm-hmm.
comes along with a plan, and he doesn't support it. He says it's against local zoning, and come on, you know, this was the what the Democrats were upset with Asserino for 6 years ago. You know,
that's
that was
that
whole
true.
HUD thing, and
yes.
so therefore we are not. They're taking the completely opposite position against Governor Hochul's plan because they say it disrupts local zoning. Well, who's to blame for local zoning? The local
exactly.
communities. And the local communities aim it to keep minorities out.
Yeah, that's
to
that's
keep
the bottom
out
line.
Big complexes, to allow huge houses to be built on 2 acres of land or something, to keep attracting high paying real estate taxes, and
yeah.
also to keep in power, because nobody wants an apartment building near them, or God forbid we have townhouses. And
mm-hmm.
then you have the situation when here in White Plains when they didn't even want a private school to be built on the country club property, and they spent 11 years fighting that, and now
yes.
we make it 100 homes. Then are they going
yeah.
to be affordable homes, little Levitt towns? No, they're going
no.
to be mansions, priced from $1.5 million to $5 million. The whole problem is the politicians are supported by the very wealthy members of the community who stand to have their private, pristine little manors disrupted by, heaven forbid, a Latino family moving in into the neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that Mara Gay wrote a fantastic piece in the New York Times 2 weeks ago about the
mm-hmm.
whole redlining history of Westchester County. I remember, I think I spoke about this last week, about
yes, you did.
Sidney Poitier, the actor, was the first black person to live in Pleasantville.
Yeah.
Why, a house, a nice house.
Mm-hmm.
And he only was able to do that because he was famous. In fact, that's
yeah.
where you get equality, by becoming famous, by becoming a big money maker in records and recordings or in movies. And that's who is. You have to erase your minority-ness by being a majoritist. Or whatever,
mm-hmm.
I'm invisible right there. But this
yeah.
is sordid history. And Mara Gay lined it all up, and it was very funny. but nobody responded to that. There were no letters to the editors, which I found fascinating. Well,
it's
look,
cool.
I mean, it called it what it was, and we forget that history. And therefore, getting back to Paul Finer, he makes an excellent point. Giving tax breaks to communities that will allow and change their zoning.
Exactly.
We do not know exactly how they would be applied. But, I mean, lots of things have been proposed recently. Not lots, but there was one where there was a law to prohibit people from building an addition onto their property, which could be rented out.
Correct.
And
that
was a feeble effort to try and get folks to allow more housing and on these large tracts. And what are these communities? Pound Ridge, Bedford, Somers, the Chappaquas, Mount Pleasant, a notorious town for redlining. And it just is another battle being fought, and this time the Democrats are fighting against it. I mean, come on. That is so hypocritical. You can't say we need 11,000 affordable housing units in Westchester County and then oppose a sweeping proposal that would target the discriminating towns, and that's what they are.
It's true. Well, let me move on to a couple of other issues, because we only have a little bit over 15 minutes left. The New York State Campaign Finance Program was intended to take effect in 2024, but it's at the risk of being scuttled. Concept was to supposedly lessen the influence of big donors during the election process. Do we know who is attempting to put a kibosh on the concept? And Albany legislators are considering delaying the matching of $12 for every $1 of small donors' contributions in this fall's election.
This was pointed out. Yeah, this is pointed out by the League of Women Voters. God bless their hearts. They have become very active on this issue, and at least somebody is, because the politicians certainly aren't. What the politicians want to do is they want to postpone this past the elections coming
2024.
So that it does not apply, because they're afraid that challengers to their already incumbent positions will get more money and be able to have more standard campaigns. It's a way to stop small candidates from challenging them, and certainly primary them. Primary is a big danger for a do-nothing incumbent, of which many are. As you know, the primary enables, it costs money to run a primary. You get very little time to run it. You have to spend money to get some sort of traction and visibility and introduce yourself. And if the small candidate challenging in a primary, or a new candidate, not necessarily a small one, but they would benefit from this, and the incumbents could get more of a possibility of getting primaried out, which would
absolutely
be wonderful. This is what happened to that's what brought Adam Bradley to the fore. He primaried a longtime assembly person and beat her in a very close election many years ago. This was back in early part of this century, believe it or not. You know, it's 20th grade, and, you know, it was the early part of the century. But that is the danger. The primary is the only real threat to an incumbent. And they don't want the new candidate to benefit from this $12 to one match that could improve finances about 10 times for the primary challenger. And they don't want that, and they want to postpone it past the election because at any time, this time, it's really a high-stakes state elections. The Democrats have already announced plans to retake the 6 Republican seats that they ceded because they cheated on gerrymandering. And they have no one to blame for that but themselves, and they're ignorance of the law or their sense of hubris that no one would notice. But that's history, and now they're stuck with this.
Well, you're on target with that. Well, I want to move on to the last issue that I would like to consider bringing up. And you've been quite prolific and on target with respect to disseminating information about the COVID crisis and other modalities that people should consider taking, such as being inoculated in order to protect themselves and so on and so forth. But now it seems that the public and private sector health officials and public policymakers really should be considering to team up immediately with community leaders to more effectively disseminate accurate narratives regarding the life-saving benefits of vaccines to counter widespread harmful misinformation from anti-vaccine activists. But at the same time, do they blame the anti-vaccine activists more than they blame themselves? Because should they also take responsibility for equivocating on their position? I think that's what really emboldened the anti-vaccine activists.
I think you're right. I think that they have done a lousy job for 2 years. The vaccines are available and they're promoted well, but they're not in a lot of locations. You have to schlep to White Plains to get the vaccines.
That's true.
Maybe you can get them in pharmacies, and there's a huge website to make appointments on the county level, but there has not been a push. I mean, could you pay people to get the vaccine? That's a possibility.
Mm-hmm.
You could.
Yeah.
Pay people to get vaccinated who aren't. Of course, that would.
Because
but
at
I mean,
the end of
hey,
the day,
hey,
that would probably save us
something.
Money overall, wouldn't it? Overall, that
would
save us more money because of the economic
of
capacity.
You're absolutely right, because the White Plains Hospital Medical Center in downtown White Plains is now finding that half of every one of their hospital admissions as of last week, had COVID.
That's half.
Now, nobody's talking about that or writing about it except me.
I know.
And I haven't even checked all the other hospitals in the county because the website that the state puts out, though it's quite complete, is very difficult to navigate.
Mm.
You know, it's tough to do a fast search, and it's done by whoever owns the hospitals instead of the actual names of the hospitals. But it's accessible. Now, what happens is that when people don't get vaccinated, they get the disease. They just eventually are more susceptible. So they go in and get really sick, and then they go in and they're really taking up capacities in hospitals, particularly the the EERs.
Yeah.
And this is a growing thing. It's not going away. It started in January, and then it sort of slacked off the first week of February and the third week, but now it's back up. Now, what was February? Big vacation month.
Yeah.
Big holiday.
But John, do you think that there's an understanding by the public about the prospect? Not everyone gets it, but there are some people who get infected with COVID, and they have long-term COVID, and it debilitates them over a few years. But they lose their weight, they lose their hair, they lose their capacity to eat food. Everything falls apart. Their whole system breaks down. And it is absolutely a horrible way to wither away eventually over time. But it is so, so debilitating. And I don't know if people recognize that this, you know, just being inoculated could protect them from getting long COVID, while others may just be protected and they would never have gotten long COVID anyway, because some people get COVID and they overcome it. Exactly.
They didn't go back for completing the series of vaccinations and the booster. This is the big problem. People are not getting their booster. They're listening to the happy talk from Albany and the New York State Health Department and the State Education Department that lifted masks and lifted reports on who's getting it in the schools, and we don't know.
We don't know exactly.
So if they had not lifted it, like last year, the White Plains School District had 25% of their school population, pupils, teachers, administrators, get COVID, even when they were on remote learning.
Yeah.
And it increased when they opened. I mean, that's just one to go on. And White Plains School District was pretty adamant about it. But this year, they dropped the reporting. They dropped it. And they haven't talked about it at all.
Yonkers never reported it at all. Yonkers never reported it, but there were a lot of teachers out and kids too. It was really disgusting.
Now, the fact is, I just think this is negligent.
What do you mean? How do you mean that?
It's negligence not providing information how many kids were getting infected, how many people were sent home.
Do you think even the governor issues a statement maybe once a week. I don't remember exactly what it is because I really didn't pay attention to that, but we do report it.
Well, there's no reason to. There is no reason to. The reason is it's the same message every day.
Except the messages are just numbers. Do we need to have a narrative that will explain that these numbers show that too many people are not being inoculated, and the question is why?
Exactly. The reporter looking at the figures there's too limited a time frame.
Mm-hmm.
You know that they'll do 3 or 4 days and showing the hospitalizations, all that. This is giving you the overall picture. The only way you can do it is a running total from January 1st to January 31st. We had something like 300 COVID cases in Westchester County, for example.
Yeah.
And that's the way you can see what it is. I mean, 300 people is 300 people. That's 300 people who could spread it to one other person. And they're not just spreading it to one other person. They're spreading it at the latest figures for Westchester. So they're spreading it to about 6 people. And I think that's gone down a little. But, it fluctuates. depending about how many infections you have. And so, therefore, it's tough. You know, that's what they have these big experts upstate to do with data. And they, and I'm sorry, the governor is going to get really hurt on COVID because she's trying to walk right down the middle, being warning about COVID, but not actually doing something about it.
Yeah, I think
and,
that that's,
I'm sorry,
that's,
but that's just
the
what
disconnect.
She's doing.
That's the disconnect. So I don't know. I don't know why she would be afraid to be more forceful about the need.
She can't. She can't.
Why do you think
the legislature?
Not?
Yes, the legislators do not have taken away her power to do an executive order to in a health emergency. They did that to Governor Cuomo, and she's just being victimized by it, but you know the legislators are not going to do anything because they want everybody to get back to normal and keep the New York gravy train of economy going.
Yeah.
So if we actually have an outbreak, now right now we're really decreasing. We've gone to an 11th consecutive week of reducing COVID, but we haven't reduced it that much. You're still getting about 500 infections a week. A week.
Yeah, that's huge.
And
yeah, that's huge.
That is about 1,000 a month. No, more than that. Yeah. Right. It's about 1,500 to 2,000 a month. Now, why don't we see that? Because there is no running total given. When the county had it town by town, when the county had its town by town site, which they have suspended now for a month, I used to total it all up town by town. I had a top 20. They must have loved that. I'm sure they didn't. That's why they suspended it, because they suspended it now to propose the myth that it is declining in Westchester, but it is not declining to an extent that it's not going to cause infections. Now, you know, we have to see what's going to happen in April, May, and June, and July, when we soared to the 10,000 mark in July.
It's a bit frightening that we don't have a good promotion to warn the public, because it seems we're more interested, and I don't know how to balance it. We're more interested in maintaining the business environment than we are people's health. And I guess it's cheaper to lose 2,000 people a month to COVID, as long as the restaurants are open and you could still continue to shop and get food delivered and stuff like that.
Yes. Promote
it's
real
all
estate.
About the economy.
Yes.
Yeah.
In fact, you have real estate is to blame for what we were speaking about earlier, affordable housing. They don't want to sell
Yeah.
They don't want to. They're made much more commission on housing. And as far as COVID goes, right now we are in a holding pattern. If you don't have the statistics, you cannot say what the COVID is doing. And I think they're going to make an effort to stop putting out these daily reports.
I think so.
And when they stop that, you are really putting the public at risk.
Yeah.
Don't have a handle.
Well, because
but
we
I mean,
haven't
that's
convinced
what
the public
are.
To the efficacy of the program, and that's really the fault of government, because evidently when people like you write about it and you try to inform the public, they see a different message coming from other sources, and they don't buy into it because it's easier not to. Easier to be,
easier.
You know, it's a problem. It's like denial.
Denial, well, indeed. It's like the story of the military preparing for a war in the Pacific and telling the world about it. That is the stupidest story I've ever seen done. The military is promoting how good it is. They should just be quiet, speak softly, and carry a big stick if necessary. I mean,
I didn't realize it. I have to carry a big stick at the moment, too, because we've come to the end of our half an hour, so we've got to move on to Michael Edelman. Forgive me. All the best to you, and thank you for your input, as usual. Be well.
Yes, so long from the ivory tower.
Take care. Take care. Goodbye.
So long for now.
Okay, bear with me a moment. Let's bring in Michael Edelman. Good morning, Mr. Edelman. How are you? Thanks for waiting.
Good morning. How are you, Hezzy?
I'm very excited to be able to speak to you, and I'm feeling well. You know, one thing that's come out, the approval ratings for President Biden have skyrocketed. They're the highest level in almost a year, while former President Donald Trump is trying to make some headway, is hoping to take his job back. So at the same time, we've got other people getting into the mix, like Nikki Haley and so on and so forth. What's the prospect of Republican voters being able to eclipse the president at this time? Or does that not seem like a logical outcome, even though it's a year away?
Well, yeah, there are two very different scenarios going on. Even though most Democrats indicate that they do not want Joe Biden to be the nominee, nevertheless, Joe Biden says he's going to run, and nobody's challenging him at this point in time.
Exactly. That's true.
So he will be the nominee of the Democratic Party because the Democrats feel that they absolutely know Joe Biden can beat Donald Trump because he already has.
Yes.
So, in addition, Joe Biden has an advisory committee, which you probably have not heard of, where he has corralled all the Democratic governors, like Pritzker of Illinois and Newsom of California, to serve on the advisory committee, which, you know, as a practical matter, takes them out of play. So they're his advisory committee. So while they're on his advisory committee, they're not going to run against him, right? So the only time that somebody will run against Joe Biden is if Joe Biden takes himself out of the race, which he has yet to do, and which at this point I doubt he's going to do. Now, so that brings us...
Yeah, he seems to be functioning very well.
Exactly. And he's done very well legislatively in terms of the bills that have gotten passed with bipartisan support. Okay, so fact of the matter is that in terms of record, Biden has the record, and he will be proud to run on that record. Now, we come to the Republican Party.
Three of them running, aren't they going to dissipate the capacity to win altogether?
First of all, it's going to be a lot more than three by the time this gets going. 30% of the Republican Party is owned and barreled by Donald Trump. They will be with Trump no matter what he does, whether he runs or whether he decides not to run. He can upset the apple cart because if he says, do not come and vote because I don't support the nominee because it isn't me, they will do exactly that, which leaves 70% of the Republican Party up for grabs with the following people. Asa Hutchinson, the former governor of Arkansas, is probably going to get in. Ron DeSantis is definitely going to get in. Nikki Haley will get in. Mike Pompeo will get in.
Wow.
And there are others like Greg Abbott of Texas who are sitting in the wings. Larry Hogan of Maryland took himself out yesterday.
Wow.
He was going to run, and he said, I'm no longer going to run. But you're correct in that if all of those Republicans split 70% of the vote, Trump cruises to the nomination with 30.
Yeah. Well, this is going to be mind-boggling, as they say. So we have to take out the popcorn and sit there.
Yeah, exactly. Well, exactly. It's going to be very exciting. The only more exciting than a Indiana Jones movie. But the thing here is that the Republicans that are going to announce for the presidency, other than Donald Trump, are going to have to at some point realize that the only way to stop Trump is with one candidate. Therefore, if the polling shows that this guy's getting 4%, that guy's getting 6%, this guy's getting 7%, but Ron DeSantis is getting 30%, they're going to have to drop out.
Right.
If they don't drop out, Trump's the automatic nominee in a multi-person primary. Now, here's the kicker. Let's assume Donald Trump is the nominee of the Republican Party and Joe Biden's the nominee of the Democratic Party. You have people that are nominally Republicans like Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger who can run on an independent line as independent Republicans and siphon Republican votes away from Donald Trump.
Uh-huh. Wow. And do you think that that's a likelihood? Well, it looks like we lost Michael Edelman, but he'll probably be calling back for whatever reason. So that sometimes happens when you get disconnected. So we'll see very shortly. So we might as well just wait and see. He'll probably be calling back because he'll realize that we're not hearing him and he's not hearing us. So that happens. Well, what a great – oh, here he is again. Bear with me. Sorry, we somehow lost you for a moment there. Thanks for calling back, Michael. The concept is really mind-boggling. Do you think that the other candidates would actually pull away to afford DeSantis a front at the front of the pecking order, so to speak?
09-23.
Sorry, Michael. Okay, for some reason we're not hearing him, but there's all kinds of stuff in the background. So, hello, Michael. Okay, we'll find out very soon. Maybe he'll be calling back. Bear with me a second. I want to just check to see if I could do this on my own. And see if we can do this. 1 minute here. Okay, what I'm going to try to do is, Michael, can you hear me? Okay, evidently not. So not a problem. 1 second. Okay. All right, we're gonna try to dial him up.
You've reached Mike. Please leave a message.
Okay. All right. So evidently, Mike. Okay, that didn't work. So we're going to try him one more time. For some reason, he's trying to hook up somehow, and we're not able to get through. Okay, we'll try him again. Oh, sometimes this technology stuff just stinks.
You've reached Mike. Please leave a message.
Okay. All right. Well, he's probably pontificating all this time, so we're going to have to see what happens and just await his calling us back. So, because evidently he's probably on the other – he is on the other line or something's happened to the line, and all we hear is some sort of noise. Which is not working out very well. So, well, we have, I'm not sure though, before we were able to get on, I'm not sure if Robert Keston, who I expected will come here at 11 o'clock, I'm not sure he's going to be able to attend at that particular moment, so we'll find out soon enough. at 11, and if not, then what we'll do is we'll move in on the to find out what's going on the international stage with news, and that at 11:30 we're going to speak to Rabbi Mindy Hurwitz, who is a rabbi that's aligned with the Chabad movement. So it's going to be very interesting because we're going to talk to him about the Purim, and we're going to talk about its significance and why it is important and what it tries to tell us. Okay, let me try, Michael. Hopefully we'll be able to connect with him. So we're going to try
You've
to
reached
get a hold
Mike.
Of Michael.
Please leave a message.
Okay. So hold on a minute. Looks like maybe Mike is on now on his own. Hello, Mike. 1 second. Hello, Michael.
Yeah, you hear me? Yeah, but I don't know what happened.
I can hear you now. I don't know what happened either. Because
all of a sudden,
I heard all kinds
of noise.
It might
have been on my side. Yeah. I have no idea.
It doesn't matter. Whatever it is, it is. But you've overcome it and so on and so forth.
Yes, I have.
I tried to call you, and what I don't know where the fault lies. You know what? A lot of the technology, even though it's supposed to work 100%, time doesn't, sometimes the glitches are there.
Exactly.
So
did you get my last? You got my last thing about Liz Cheney, right? That was the last thing I said.
Yeah, the last thing I heard is about Liz Cheney conceivably entering the race as an independent.
Liz and Adam are going to do everything they possibly can. All right, they don't want to be president. That's not what it's about. They're going to do everything they can to make sure Donald Trump is not.
Right. And that's a brilliant move on their part, which is terrific.
Yeah. Yes.
Really very, very good. One thing I want to ask you, when we learned that Rupert Murdoch and his operation on Fox News, which he owns, and the New York Post and other publications, he was aware that there was a false narrative with regard to President Trump. He claimed that he didn't lose the race for presidency, and yet Murdoch did know that he lost the contest against
Biden.
They
all knew. It's not just
they
Murdoch.
They all knew. Right.
Hannity knew. Ingram knew. Pirro knew. The point is that their emails, their private emails, indicated they thought Trump was nuts and that his claims were bullshit, all right, and that Rudy Giuliani was out of his mind. But in order to keep their viewers from migrating to a more conservative network that followed Trump's lie, they told the lie as well. Shame on them. But even worse, the owner of the broadcast network knew the truth, and he didn't phone in and demand his on-air opinion hosts tell the truth. And he indicated that's terrible testimony, by the way, in a defamation case where you've got to prove actual knowledge because it's based on New York Times versus Sullivan. It's not enough to show what you said was false. You have to show you knew it was false when you said it.
Yeah.
And they clearly did.
They did. Yes, because of the emails that were revealed.
Yeah, they knew Trump lost. As a matter of fact, the Fox News desk, the real, election desk called Arizona for Trump before ABC, NBC, CBS, and CNN did.
Yes, I remember that.
So they absolutely, the news department knew that he lost the election. They knew that the claims that there were irregularities was nonsense. 60 times they went to court and lost. 60 times the judge threw it out. So they knew, but they kept up the pretense to satisfy Trump and not to lose their viewers. And that, my dear friend, is the definition of defamation under the Times versus Sullivan case.
But what causes people who work for whoever the boss is, and they feel that it's appropriate for them to even malign the news because they thought they could, and they did for a long time. The narrative was strong.
The answer is ratings and money.
It's ratings and money.
They're not Hezzy. I have been saying this for 5 years. These are not news people. They are not journalists. They have no obligation to tell the truth because that's not what they do. They're an opinion host only. These people have an opinion. They're the propaganda arm of the Republican Party and Donald Trump. And they will do anything they can to keep their viewers happy, including telling lies, because that's what they do.
Well, but you've always pointed out that they were opinionators, and they had an opinion rather than reporting the news.
Yeah, but
people
don't know that. Nobody knows that. Those people that watch Fox News don't understand the difference.
Right. I don't know how it got to the point where they became ignorant, or were they always ignorant?
Yeah.
I mean, I can't imagine that
people were adults that couldn't figure it out. Pretty much 35% of the people in this country is stupid. That's at least.
Yeah.
You know that only 30% of the people have college educations, which means
only
the 30%? Ability to think. Yeah, that's right.
Well,
which means that, by and large, rational thinking is missing.
Well, to be honest, I know some people who I thought who have a good education, supposedly astute, but there's like a visceral concept that's inculcated into their mind somehow, and they're supporting Trump to this day. They're waiting for him for a resurgence.
There are those who have educations who are diehard conservatives and who don't care who wins the Republican as long as the Democrats don't.
But that's
not a lot of people. They want to keep socialists away, quote unquote socialists. There's a resolution in the House pending now that socialism is bad. So what they're trying to do is say that Democrats who are passing bills are socialists.
Yeah.
Well, if you think socialism is bad, then we don't. Wait a minute. We don't need Social Security. We don't need Medicare. We don't need Medicaid. Mm-hmm. Okay?
Yeah.
We don't need food stamps. We don't need federal help for projects.
Yeah.
We need none of that because that's socialism by definition. But real socialism is the government ownership of the means of production. And we do not have that in this country.
Yeah, but I guess people who believe in the Trumpsters, they don't recognize what they're saying or the dogma that's being promoted, do they? I don't think they recognize that would be the end of funding for education and for the elderly and for the sick and so on and so forth, and food stamps and everything you can imagine.
They've been persuaded over the last few decades by radio stars like Rush Limbaugh and television opinion hosts like Bill O'Reilly, who had to leave, and Sean Hannity and Ingram Imperial. They've been persuaded that somehow Donald Trump is a savior. But he's not. And he lost the election to Joe Biden, and he'll lose again. Because he's acting like a jackass when you see him on television.
Yeah.
I am your retribution.
Retribution.
What does that mean?
I was blown away. I'm not quite sure what it means.
Well, it means he's appealing to people who want payback for whatever wrongs they believe were done to them electorally.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, but it was very, very arrogant to hear him say that. But it was such a pompous manner and tone.
He's reading the bullshit that Stephen Miller writes for him. He doesn't write those speeches. He can't put a sentence together himself.
Oh, is that Stephen Miller? I didn't realize that because I don't. I know of Stephen Miller, but not very much else.
Yep.
That's
he's
it.
The he's the number one speechwriter. When you see Trump at a rally, it's Stephen Miller's work. And you can tell when he's reading the teleprompter, these are not his words, they're Miller's words. And the only way he adopts it to his style is when you have a word in there like, you know, we're going to do this this way, he'll
uh-huh.
repeat the this way to himself very
uh-huh.
strongly. We're tough. He'll go very tough. He doesn't
mm-hmm.
write any of this stuff. These are not coming
uh-huh.
from his mind. Stephen Miller
wow.
sits at Mar-a-Lago and writes speech after speech after speech, peddling the same garbage. Not one word about policy, only about grievance and
grievance.
Retribution.
And so one thing about with the Murdochs, has their operation undermined the entire news media, print and television and radio? Can we overcome that? Because I think we've lost integrity all around.
Yeah, but a $1.6 billion verdict in a defamation case will send a message.
Yeah.
And the people of the United States will be listening because that number is enormous. And if a jury
mm-hmm.
deliberates on that number, there'll be no question that Fox did what it was accused of doing. And other media outlets have opinion hosts, but they don't lie. They have opinions.
Yes.
There's a difference between
yes,
having an opinion and knowing something
right.
is not true but saying it's true. Okay?
Mm.
So MSNBC has great opinion people on it. They don't
yes.
lie.
Yes.
CNN has less opinion and more facts, but they're not lying. They're reporting.
Yeah.
But what Fox does is simply not journalism. And now they have the emails and the fingerprints and the smoking gun from Murdoch's mouth to show exactly what I have been saying for 5 years since I started even
yes,
listening to Rush Limbaugh more than 5 years ago.
Yeah. Do the employees of someone as powerful as a Murdoch, do they succumb to the boss because of the clout, the money that they make and the money that they earn? Is it all about money for them as well, rather than integrity? Whatever happened to ethics?
Well, let me. Well, first of all, Hizzy, let me tell you of a private email that I had with one of their hosts.
Really?
Yes, really. Jeanine Pirro, who I've known for 50 years, former DA, former judge. I sent her an email when she started this nonsense on Fox with her own show, telling her you're doing a great disservice to the United States. And she wrote me back, my show is number one in its time slot.
Mm-hmm.
That was the message.
And that's what they
care about. Number one means more advertisers. You know, more eyeballs means more money and bigger salaries for those hosts. Sean Hannity makes $30-40 million a year.
Really?
He doesn't
want to
lose that. Yeah. Oh, sure. Absolutely, positively. And that kind of money is absolutely outrageous, and he's getting paid to lie.
Yeah.
He's getting paid
to
keep those viewers and keep those advertising dollars coming in, regardless of the truth.
Mm-hmm. That's amazing. I had no idea the numbers were so high. But even $1 million is a fortune.
Oh,
but $30-40 million dollars. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Amazing.
He's got the number one show.
Yeah. Absolutely mind-boggling.
There is no such thing as journalism integrity. They're not journalists.
Yeah.
They hold themselves. They don't mind if their viewers perceive them as journalists. You know what I'm saying? They do nothing.
Mm.
They do nothing to dispel the notion that they know what they're talking about and that they are journalists. so that when people take their listen to their shows and take away the big lie that Trump is talking about and the election fraud and the election denial bullshit, when they do that, they don't care that their viewers repeat it, and it's a non-truth because they
yeah.
want to outdo the nearest competitor, which is Newsmax and OANN, and keep the eyeballs uh-huh. on Fox. And they know their
wow.
viewers want to hear that. Their viewers don't want to hear that Donald Trump lost because Donald Trump says he didn't lose. It's a vicious cycle.
When we realize or when it becomes known, if it ever becomes known for the listener to Murdoch, either on Fox News or in the newspapers that he owns, will that put an end to this debacle of this lack of truth? It could sink his whole operation, couldn't it? It would just disintegrate.
Well,
yeah,
you know, $1.6 billion is not beanball. It's a lot of money.
Yeah, it's a fortune.
Murdoch makes most of his profit from Fox.
Yeah. Truly amazing. Truly amazing.
Yep.
So how do you stomach listening to all this news when it's not news and it's just opinion? I don't know how you keep up with it.
There's no point after these emails come. Why would you listen to Fox after you read those emails?
Yeah, exactly.
I don't understand. Any intelligent voter, with or without a college education, why would they listen to a network when they know the opinion hosts have been lying to them?
Mm. I hear you. It's just amazing what's going on. Well, anyway, any last words from you? Where should we go from here, or what should we look forward to?
We look forward to a defamation judgment, which requires Fox
uh-huh.
News not only to pay $1 billion+, but requires them to run for a week or 2 weeks on their network the fact that they told an untruth about the 2020 election. And they told an untruth about the election denied. They need to tell their viewers they lied to them. That's what they need to do. Now, that may destroy Fox News, but that's too bad.
Yeah. Do you think that he's got the intestinal fortitude to do that?
Well, he's an old man. This could kill him. Well, this might kill him. You know, something like this.
And what about
$1 billion? One of them is a liberal, believe it or not, and one of them is a conservative.
Yes.
So they're going to have to battle it out as to which way Fox News goes. Does Fox News want to be a conservative network that tells the truth, or does it want to be known as a propaganda arm of Donald Trump and the Republican Party?
Well, it would make more sense that they could be a credible outlet. I don't know if it would be so difficult for them to just switch the door, you know, the room, and for people to say, okay, well, where would these people go?
You know what?
The listeners.
It doesn't matter because they already made their fortunes, so they don't need – you don't have to worry about Sean and Laura and Janine. They'll be just fine.
Well, that should be a lot of fun. Well, looks like I've got to answer the call because they're going to be delivering drugs, you know, for me, you know, medicine rather. So I'll speak to you next week.
All right.
Thank you so much. Be well.
Yeah. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
You too.
Bye. Okay. Well, we're going to pick up the we're going to get the call. Somebody's coming up. So, hi, how are you? No, I'm waiting for somebody to come up. It's okay. Thank you.
Thanks very much. That's for me. I appreciate it. Be well. Okay, so looks like I got my delivery now, and then I'm going to go back. We'll see in a moment if Mr. Keston is able to make the broadcast. I'm not sure. We'll see what happens. And if he is, then he'll be on the line. No, it looks like he may not be able to make the broadcast. So, all right, he's not called in. So it looks like we're going to be able to, we'll cover international news with you in the meantime. And at 11:30, we're expecting none other than Mindy Hurwitz, the rabbi. We're going to talk to him about Purim. So in the meantime, bear with me a moment as I move on to get some international news. Bear with me a second. First, let me go to our local place. 1 minute. Local news, and see if we can cover a couple of items for you there. Bear with me a moment. this I found very, very interesting. It seems that 150 Downing Street is the address that's been approved, the approved location for the Ludlow Point rental development in Yonkers. So a new multifamily rental property development designated as Ludlow Point has gained approval for Ginsburg Development Companies to construct a new multifamily property at 150 Downing Street in Yonkers, New York. The development will be comprised of 208 apartments, a number of amenity locations, and 229 parking spaces. So the bifurcated property is defined by a two-tower complex that will rise to 7 stories in height. It's an enticing array of amenities, include a lounge, a fitness center, a swimming pool, a business center, bike racks, and private storage facilities. And the ground floor is anticipated to be replete with retail and dining venues. So Ginsburg Development has allocated $65 million for the project and create approximately 625 construction jobs. So, and as we're starting to write now as well on the website, for every article, the Yonkers Tribune asks our readers to send the editor, which is me, your tips as well as story ideas. And you could send it to the my email address, ihezi18@proton.me. So it's ihezi18@proton.me. And so that's pertinent, so to speak. Bear with me a second. 1 minute. Okay. All right. And bear with me a second here. Okay. So I'm going to move back. And 1 second. This I think you'll find very interesting. This is an article written by Calvis Golde, G-O-L-D-E is the way he spells his last name. And he asks the question, what level of suspicion do police need to enter a home without a search warrant for an arrest? Now, just so you know, Calvis Golde handles petitions for the Supreme Court of the United States blog. His duties include monitoring newly filed cert petitions, updating the petitions and We're Watching page, and writing the Petitions of the Week column. Cal is also the assistant director of the Supreme Court Institute of Georgetown Law School, where he helps plan moot courts for advocates arguing in front of the court. From 2019 to 2021, he was the blog manager of scotusblog.com, and He previously worked at the American Constitution Society and interned at the Center for American Progress. And Cal graduated from the University of Georgia with a Bachelor of Science in Applied Mathematics. So on March 4th, he wrote that the Petitions of the Week column highlights a selection of certification or cert petitions recently filed in the Supreme Court. A list of all petitions we're watching is available, and there's a link to the ones that are available and that he's watching. It is unconstitutional for police to enter a home without a warrant to arrest someone if they do not have, quote, reason to believe, end quote, the suspect is in the home. This week, we highlight cert petitions that ask the court to consider, among other things, whether that standard is equal to a showing of probable cause needed to obtain a warrant or something lesser. Tracy Pennington lives in Ripley, West Virginia. Because her daughter, S.W., missed too many days of school, the state placed her under the maternal grandparents. S.W. soon ran away and stopped going to school entirely. Her grandparents informed social services, who got a judge to declare S.W. an active runaway and issue a, quote, pickup order, end quote, to bring her into custody. After a few unsuccessful months of searching, police received an anonymous tip that S.W. had been seen back at Pennington's apartment. The county attorney told police that they did not need a warrant to act. So when officers arrived at the apartment and no one answered the door, they got a key from the landlord and let themselves in. Entering with a weapon drawn, police searched the apartment and eventually found S.W. hiding behind a hollow dresser. Prosecutors charged Pennington in state court with felony child concealment and conspiracy. Conceding that the officers lacked probable cause to enter the home, the state offered Pennington a plea deal, which she took. Pennington then filed an appeal, arguing that the officers' search of her home without a warrant or probable cause violated the Fourth Amendment. Well, the West Virginia Supreme Court denied her appeal. The reason to believe, quote-unquote, standard for warrantless entry, the court held, requires a lower level of suspicion than probable cause. It concluded that SW's outstanding pickup order, the equivalent of an arrest warrant, combined with the uncorroborated anonymous tip, were enough to justify the entry. In Pennington versus West Virginia, Pennington asks the justices to clarify whether reason to believe, quote unquote, is equivalent to probable cause. She argues that in the silence of any of the narrow exceptions to the need for a warrant to search a home, the Fourth Amendment prohibits a weaker reading of that standard just because police have a warrant to arrest someone. Pennington contends that the divide among lower courts on this question is so deep that her case would have come out differently had she been charged in federal rather than state court in West Virginia. A list of this week's featured petitions are listed as well by Cal. ROP versus Federal Housing Finance Agency on this issue is whether the challenged decisions of the acting director of the Federal Housing Finance Agency should be vacated because the Constitution does not permit the president to designate an acting official to exercise the powers of principal officer indefinitely without the advice and consent of the Senate. Another one is Mangine versus Withers. Whether and under what circumstances relief is available under 28 U.S.C. for federal prisoners challenging errors in their sentences, and two, whether the erroneous deprivation of petitioner's statutory right to seek a sentence reduction under 18 U.S.C. constitutes a miscarriage of justice such that petitioners may obtain relief under Section 2255E. And lastly, the case is that Pennington versus West Virginia 22-747, the issue here is whether when police have an arrest warrant for a person, they can enter a home without probable cause that the person resides there and is present within. So these are the issues. Fascinating, to say the least. Now, let's just quickly look at some other issues that I think you'll find interesting. This comes from some representatives in government. Espaillat and Ciceline introduced a resolution urging Russian President Putin and government be tried for war crimes. Well, Representatives Adriano Espaillat of New York and District 13 and David Ciceline from Rhode Island, District 1, this past week introduced a resolution calling for Russian President Vladimir Putin and the Russian government to be held accountable by the international community for their ongoing violations of international law committed during the illegal and barbaric invasion of Ukraine. Well, the resolution also condemns the Russian government's gross violations of international law amounting to war crimes and crimes against humanity in Ukraine, stands in solidarity with the people of Ukraine and expresses support for the efforts of international organizations to help people displaced by war and conflict. Quote, Putin's unlawful and barbaric invasion of Ukraine makes clear his desire to return to a bygone Cold War era of conquest and violence, and the world must continue to meet this moment with strength and action, end quote, said Congressman Espaillat. Continuing Putin's barbarous assault on residential buildings, schools, synagogues, and churches across Ukraine, and his ruthless targeting of innocent Ukrainians throughout this conflict make clear he is a man without remorse, a moral compass, or respect for international law. The United States must lead in calling for accountability for Putin's monstrous action and by uniting the international community position to tyranny and unrelenting commitment to freedom. Quote, last year, I saw firsthand the pain and suffering that Putin and his government are causing with this illegal war, said Congressman Ciceline, who traveled to the Poland-Ukraine border in March of 2022. Conditions have only worsened as Putin continues his delusional quest to reconstitute the United Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, the USSR. He and the forces under his control are targeting civilians, hurting millions, and killing children. As we continue to support Ukrainians fighting back against this war criminal and work to stop this suffering, we must hold Putin to account for his crimes and make clear that the global community will not tolerate this flagrant violation of international law. Specifically, the Espaillat-Ciceline resolution stipulates the following. It condemns the continued use of unlawful and indiscriminate violence against civilian populations by the Russian government, its allies, and any other parties to the conflict. It urges the global community to hold Vladimir Putin and the Russian government accountable for war crimes committed during the military invasion of Ukraine. It also urges the United States and its allies to continue providing defense, security assistance, and humanitarian aid to Ukraine as Ukrainians valiantly defend their freedom against Russia's military invasion. Further, it supports the continued use of sanctions against Russia and its allies until Russia is held accountable for its crimes and unequivocally recognizes Ukraine's internationally recognized borders and political independence. It urges the United States to maintain support for international organizations such as the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, helping Ukrainians fleeing conflict, as well as the over 100 million people around the world who are forcibly displaced due to persecution, conflict, violence, and human rights violations. Further, urges the United States to treat all forcibly displaced people with dignity and abide by the protocol related to the status of refugees ratified by the Senate in 1968 and thereafter considered law. Further, it urges the United States and members of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, which is NATO, to meet NATO's funding needs to ensure the ability to provide collective defense and innovation. Further, it urges NATO to maintain its commitment to innovating and to work towards solving and dealing with emerging and disruptive technology. And lastly, it stands in solidarity with the people of Ukraine who are fighting for their freedom and democracy. Wow. Very well expressed, certainly, and quite lucid, to say the least. One second. Okay. This is really quite fascinating with regard to President Biden. Biden isn't serious about opposing the Palestinian terrorism, so writes Jonathan S. Tobin. A bid to strengthen the Taylor Force Act that penalizes the Palestinian authorities, a pay-for-play policy is necessary, but the administration is still evading the law in other ways. This was written in the Jewish News and by the Jewish News Syndicate. So the victim of the most recent Palestinian terror attack was a young American. His name is Elan Ganelis. A 27-year-old native of West Hartford, Connecticut, was gunned down on the road between Jericho and the Dead Sea on February 27. Though he had previously served in the Israel Defense Forces, the IDF, Ganelis was currently living in New York and was murdered while on a trip to attend a friend's wedding. While this crime was condemned by the U.S. government, the Biden administration's claims that it opposes Palestinian terrorism ring hollow for a number of reasons. Chief among them is the fact that although federal law prohibits the sending of financial assistance to the Palestinian Authority if it continues to pay salaries and pensions to terrorists, Biden continues to send aid to the Palestinian Authority with promises of more to come. The law in question is the 2018 Taylor Force Act, named after another man in his 20s who was visiting Israel. And Force also spent time in the military. He was a non-Jewish West Point graduate murdered by a Palestinian terrorist while studying abroad. The Force family and others worked tirelessly to get Congress to pass the law so as to use the immense financial leverage of the United States to pressure the Palestinian Authority and its leader, Mahmoud Abbas, to discontinue their practice of subsidizing and supporting acts of violence. In addition to signing the Taylor Force Act into law, former President Donald Trump cut off all forms of aid to the Palestinian Authority over the issue of their support of terrorism. Abbas had tried to con Trump, who was fairly ignorant about the issue when he arrived in office, into thinking that he was a man of peace on that first meeting with him in the White House. But by the time Trump met with Abbas on his visit to Israel and the territories in May of 2017, the president had gotten wise to the veteran PLO bureaucrat's grift. He reportedly pounded the table during his meeting with Abbas and demanded that he stop the pay-for-play policies. Though the Palestinians and some of their Western apologists like to argue that the money merely constitutes welfare payments to the needy, the system generates as much as $350 million a year to terrorists and those connected to them via their martyrs fund, quote unquote. Well, the payments are on a sliding scale, with those who shed blood and kill people getting more than those who merely commit assault and fail to kill their victims. So, more to the point, it is so important to the political culture of the Palestinians to desire the real financial hardships imposed by Trump's aid cutoff. Abbas refused to end those payments. Indeed, it can be argued that it would be impossible for him or any successor to the ailing 87-year-old former assistant to arch-terrorist Yasser Arafat to do so and survive against their Islamist rivals, Hamas and Palestinian Islamic Jihad based in the Gaza Strip. But rather than turning up the heat on Abbas, Trump's successor has done the opposite, as he was with most of what Trump did. Biden immediately reversed his ban on aid to the Palestinians once he took office, and vast sums have poured into various Palestinian agencies, though his foreign policy team continues to insist that they are managing all this without committing technical violations of the Taylor Force Act. They have promised to increase this aid. They're doing so in part as a way to bludgeon Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his government. Biden's team despises the current governing coalition because of its right wing and religious composition, and because of the grudges that most of them still hold against Netanyahu, dating back to their service under former President Barack Obama. Indeed, despite this recent surge of Palestinian terror that has cost the lives of 13 Israelis in the past few weeks, Washington remains focused on its anger at Netanyahu's government. And that's because of its commitment to strengthening Jewish communities in Judea and Samaria and plans for judicial reform. Though they have no right taking any position on the issue of efforts to rein in Israel's out-of-control Supreme Court, they are taking a cue about the Israeli opposition, which in turn is mimicking Democratic Party talking points in the 2022 midterm elections in the United States and claim that it threatens democracy. So, and so on and so forth. You could read the rest of the article as well on our website. And this, I think, you'll find very important as we round up the last few minutes before Rabbi Mindy Hurwitz joins us. This is the column called Westchester News and Notes, the March 2023 edition, written by Mark Jeffers, who's based in Bedford Hills in Westchester County. Welcome to Westchester News and Notes, where we look at the happenings here in Westchester County. Let's start off with some thoughts on the marvelous month of March. I hope we all get through the Ides of March with no ill effects. We remember to spring ahead on March 12th at 2 a.m. and survive the green beer on St. Patrick's Day. Cheers to this month's March Madness edition of Westchester News and Notes. With the Academy Awards around the corner, the Katona Village Improvement Society presents Oscar-nominated short film screens on Saturday, March 4th. That's already passed because we printed this earlier. Bedford 2030 will hold a community forum, The Power of Trees, on March 25th between 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. at the Fox Lane High School. Healthy Trees provide essentially ecosystem services like clean air and water, fertile soil, plentiful habitat, and increased biodiversity. Plus, trees provide shade for my afternoon naps in the summer. The forum has a fantastic lineup of speakers, activities, and real-world tips to protect our trees. I certainly need to swing up or swing by the Bedford Hills Free Library for Tech Tuesdays. You can stop by the library from 11 a.m. to 6 p.m., or you can call 914-666-6472. And technical questions are answered in person and over the phone. Personal appointments are also available, and you can contact Catherine Weimark, Librarian for Adult Services and Programs at the library. The Fun Gang at the Fox Lane Sports Booster Club presented the third annual dodgeball tournament on Friday, March 3rd at the Fox Lane Gym, and I hope that he had the opportunity to attend. The Fox Lane varsity baseball and softball teams will hold a joint clinic on March 18th from 1 to 3 in the afternoon at the Fox Lane campus. Clinics are run by varsity baseball and softball coaches, and proceeds to benefit the baseball and softball teams. And please be advised that our sports radio show, The Clubhouse, returns to the airwaves on March 8th, only a few days to go, from 7 to 8 p.m. on WGCH 1490 AM. The broadcast is conducted live from the Hub at Hotel MTK in Mount Kisco, and come and join us for some good food, fun, and maybe even some sports news. You're going to want to save this date and rest your stomach in anticipation for the 14th annual Chili Cook-Off, hosted by the Katona Chamber of Commerce on Friday, March 24th, from 5:30 to 8 p.m. at the Harvey School. And lastly, I would like to wish everyone a very happy and safe St. Patrick's Day. May the road rise to meet you. May the wind be always at your back. And may the sun shine warm upon your face and the rains fall soft upon your fields. See you all soon. Article is written by Manhattanville Sport Business Management Chairman Mark Jeffords, who's a Bedford Hills resident, and he writes the Westchester News and Notes column. And you can read this March 2023 edition by Mark Jeffords if you go to the website, the YonkersTribune.com website. Well, we've only got a few more minutes left, and we'll eventually be joined by none other than, Rabbi Mindy Hurwitz. So we're going to talk to him about the holiday that's coming up, and that's Esther. It's about Queen Esther. So we're going to talk to him about Purim, which is a holiday that celebrates what she did, and we'll see where all that goes. So let me just quickly look and see what we have here. Let me see if I can get to this page. Bear with me a moment. I'm scrolling. Yeah, here it is. So we're going to hear from the rabbi in a couple of minutes. Well, so this is going to be the final segment of the day with Chabad Rabbi Mindy Hurwitz, who relates the ritual observance of Purim, which begins with a day of fasting, Ta'anit Esther, or the fast of Easter, this Monday. That's today, the day preceding the actual holiday. And the most distinctive aspect of the synagogue service is the reading of the book of Esther. Oh, I see the rabbi is already on, so let's welcome the rabbi. Good morning, Rabbi. How are you, sir?
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me on. How are you? How's everyone?
Well, I'm fine. I don't know how all the listeners are, but I hope they're fine as well. And I'm glad that you're fine, which is really perfect as well. It's a good way to start the day. So hopefully the demeanor will gravitate to everybody who's listening and beyond. So this is a very exciting holiday, isn't it? The fast of Esther and Purim itself. What is the significance of it? And it is really telling, isn't it, that this is a holiday where we celebrate a woman. That is quite unique, though, isn't it?
Judaism always holds very highly of women. And, yes. You know, even Hanukkah also has a very big, women has a very big part in Hanukkah. Yehudit, taking yes. care of the general, and, you know, the miracle comes around. So you see great things. But today is Purim. You know, today we begin Purim. And Esther, the entire Megillah is actually called Esther. And Esther also has another significance. The name Esther also means hidden. If you look throughout the entire Megillah, which takes, you know, if you read it quickly, it takes about, at least a half hour to read. You don't find God's name in there. Where was God? It looked like everything was in hiding. And that's, you know, as we're going to go through the program today, you're going to see, we're going to learn about Purim, that we had all the connections, everything we needed, but yet we realized that all our connections in the palace, and yet there was still, they were able to come out with this terrible decree of killing every single Jew. And Esther is the one to stand up and say, you know what? We realize it's not just a decree down here from our enemies. We have to refine ourselves a bit, and that's why she called for this fast, to do teshuva, you know, repentance, to tap in, to refine ourselves. Because sometimes we have to take a little break and see, you know what? What's the importance in life? What are we aiming for? What are we looking for? You know, everything can be going well, physically, but we need to tap into our spiritual And that was the Esther's call to call for this fast. That's what's called Tainit Esther, the fast of Esther.
I didn't realize that that was the meaning behind it. Interesting. Also, one of the things that I found confusing was to memorialize the bad guy in Persia years ago. His name was Haman. And yet there's like a special type was like a cake called a hamantashen, which means Haman's pocket. In Hebrew, it's the Ozne Haman, which is the Haman's ear. And yet I know that we have like a triangular type of cookie filled with poppy seeds here in the United States and elsewhere. But why is there a different way of looking at it's Haman's pocket or Haman's ear? Does Haman's ear somehow remind us of a triangle? I missed that connection.
So I'm not sure why
the difference in the language.
Right. So some people say actually his hat was a triangular hat. You can look at it in a very interesting way that, you know, the entire theme of Purim is a turnaround, a complete turnaround. It's called Nahapachu, to turn over. Haman made a lottery. What he chose, what day are we going to kill the Jews? Should it be on Rosh Hashanah? No, you know, God, the shofar sounding and all that. He went through every single month, and his lottery came out in Adar, which is now the happiest month. And the reason why he settled for Adar, he said, hey, look, Moses passed away on the seventh day of Adar. That must be, you know, a terrible day for the Jews, very bad luck. And little did he know that Moses was also born on that day. And, you know, a tzaddik, a special person, a leader, that born and passed at the same time, something very significant, very special. Right. But so coming back, says one has to celebrate Purim till he does not know the difference between, blessed is Mordechai and cursed is Haman. So it could be the theme over there of having these triangular cookies is showing that, you know, Haman, he's defeated. Today we could even laugh it off and enjoy this thing. And, you know, be able to, actually, some people, very interesting, during the reading of the Megillah, his name is also mentioned so many times. We're not applauding him. We're actually erasing his name. We boo him. We take our graggers and we make noise. We erase. The mitzvah is to erase the Amalek, to erase their name. Some people have this very interesting custom. If anyone listening that's going to be going to Shul tonight, you may see, or you can notify people of this custom to actually write the name of Haman on the bottom of his shoe. So when you're stamping, when you're walking, you're actually erasing his name.
Oh, I never knew about that. That's terrific. I love it. I'll have to do that. My goodness. Okay. That is amazing. Truly amazing. And what is it also about Judaism and the religion that upholds women to high esteem, and yet so many in society do not?
I think it's a little bit of a misconception. No one puts women on any other bracket. In Judaism, just the opposite. And from a Jewish perspective, a woman is actually in a higher bracket. And therefore, from all the mitzvot, there's 613 commandments. There are so many that are only related to women. So many are related to men. Others are related only if you're living in Israel. Another related if you're a Kohen, a priest. Right? No one can perform all 613. Now, the women do have certain mitzvot that are designed only for women. But there's so many that are not for women, and the reason for that being is because the woman is in a higher spiritual level, they don't need a reminder. Think of it as you know, if you have a class with many students, if you know that, you know, some students, you know, if they're not going to be occupied, they're going to be making some trouble or disturbing not catching their attention fully. So in order to do that, the teacher would have to give them more things or different things to do to keep them occupied, that they should, right? So that's, God gave that to us, to men. before we go out to work, before we think, you know, we're the greatest and, God, you know, we're most talented, which we have to, yes, 100%. God gave us a special talent, but we have to recognize that. Who gave it to us? We put on tefillin in the morning. Every boy from the age of 13 and up puts on tefillin. Women are not obligated to put on tefillin. They don't have that requirement. Why? Because when they go out, when they take care of what they need to take care of that day, when they wake up, right away they remember God. They remember all these gifts are God. And so men have to remind ourselves more. That's why God, that's why God gave us so much more thing, you know, many other mitzvahs to do, to remind, to keep that constant reminder that, you know, our great talents come from the blessing from above. Again, women, on the other hand, have that more of a constant reminder, and therefore they don't have to, have that reminder. A lot of times it tells, you know, people that I speak to are different congregants, if your car doesn't need a boost in the morning, you're not going to boost it because your neighbor had to boost their car, right? If your car turns on, it turns on. Women's batteries turn on right away. The spiritual level is all there. And we, the men have to, we have to add a little bit to it to make sure that we don't fall behind.
I see. I had not known that. But that's very telling.
Yes. Again, women is very high in Judaism. Very high. Very high. The soul comes from a, if you want to go into Kabbalah, says the soul comes from a different, from a higher level, so-called, than where the men's, where boy souls come from. Yeah.
So are we losing our way in society by, you know, trying to somehow diminish the, I guess, the stature of women in today's society? And how do we get back to a sense where at least we show them equal respect, if not even greater respect?
So that all boils down to the Torah is our blueprints. The Torah is our guidelines.
Right.
Sometimes we try to, you know, we think it's just a book, a very intelligent book. It has so much. And by the way, that's Hanukkah. Hanukkah, the Greeks looked at the Torah as such an intelligent book. Wow, you know what? Learn it and read it because it can sharpen your mind, not because God gave it to us. And they gave us the option, so-called. You can learn Torah. We're not going to kill you. But if you're going to keep Judaism, we're going to kill you. If you're going to observe, if you're going to do things for religious purposes, we're going to kill you. If you're willing to convert, then we have nothing against you.
Mm-hmm.
So they noticed. They saw the value in the Torah, but they wanted to take out the Yiddishkeit, the Judaism from it. Haman comes around in the story of Purim. He says every Jew... He decreed every single Jew should be killed on this day, and so getting back to the point, the idea is if we're taking it as an intellectual book, so today we can think this way, we could have this feeling, and tomorrow, you know what? It's not fair. We should be more equal, or you know, once you let your own mind come into it, that's where it can be problematic. For sure, Torah wants you to be able to think on your own and to understand and that, but you have to see the fundamental basis of the Torah and that it's a God-given gift and we can't change, you can't change it around. You know, we can't edit the Torah to our comfort. We can edit our comfort to the Torah, right? You have to see which one you're bringing down, who's coming to who. This is the godly gift. And that's why, that's another point of answering your question, how do we not lose this society, not just with women, but even in our Judaism? Look at it. There's an interesting question. We're going to read the Megillah tonight, and it says, Mordechai HaYehudi, Mordechai the Jew. Wait, don't we all know that Mordechai was the Jew? What's this business, Mordechai HaYehudi? Right, and it only mentions it twice. Beginning?
Why?
Right. So in the beginning of the Megillah, right, so, and it's mentioned like that in the beginning and in the end, but during the Megillah, every time we read Mordechai's name, it just says Mordechai. So why is it starting and ending? So the answer to that is Mordechai was the only Jew that lived in the capital of Persia, the only Jew. And being the only Jew living there, the Megillah is telling us Mordechai HaYehudi, this Mordechai, that is the only Jew living in the capital, he remained and he valued his Judaism so close and so important. Him and Esther, they kept to their Judaism no matter what. And that's what the Megillah is telling us. To be able to be a strong Jew in today's society, so for sure you should be friendly with everybody and respect everybody and understand everybody. But when it comes to our Yiddishkeit, we can't start cutting and editing and trying to fit in, so-called. We have to do it the way it's proper and respectful for everybody. And that's why by the end of the Megillah, when Mordechai was very close, he got involved. I wouldn't say he got involved in politics, but he got involved with you know, being an advisor and being close to the king. He didn't let that get to him. He still remained HaYehudi. He didn't change his meaner. He didn't change the way he lived as a Jew. And that's what the Megillah is telling us. You want to be a strong Jew, no matter where you're living. It could be in Yonkers, anywhere in Westchester, in the South, or wherever you are.
Uh-huh.
Keep to the values of what God gave us in a respected way, uh-huh. in a proper way, and people are going to respect you and like you, and you're going to be able to live together in peace. You have to do it in a proper way.
Wow.
You can't start changing things to, you know, to today's society the way we feel it should be or differently. That's
So the template is already written for us. We just need to abide by it. And is that also one of the issues that actually, I guess, is that like the proponent of so much of the anti-Semitism that you see today?
In a sense, I would say, you know, think of it. We're living amongst many different people, not necessarily Jewish people. And your neighbor likes you, your neighbor is good with you, but they don't know that you're Jewish.
Yeah.
They don't necessarily see the Hanukkah. They don't see the Hanukkah menorah in your window when it comes Hanukkah. They just think, you know, you're a nice, good person, but they don't know that they're Jewish. If they would know that you're Jewish and say, wait, when they hear something about a Jew, no, they're going to go stand up and defend it. I'm sorry, I have a very nice person living right next to me. He is Jewish and his family is well-behaved and nice, good people, ethical people and proper people. And they go to synagogue and, you know. So often if we let people know, I feel sometimes we're in the hiding and people don't even know, oh, that guy is Jew. I didn't even know. So, yeah, if
really?
We, yeah, if I feel that if to answer your question, if we're proud of who we are, not proud like in a bad way, but proud properly, we're not hiding. We're not trying to fit in, so-called. We're celebrating the holidays that we're supposed to celebrate and open. And yeah, who we are, and you're proper, good people, and nice to your neighbors, and good to the people around. People are going to say, you know what? I have a different opinion. It's not true. It's a misconception. It's you know, out there, whatever they say. It's you know, you'll always find problems here or there. But overall, you know, my neighbor is nice, and my people are nice, and so we have to do our self-advertising. We have to stand up for ourselves and properly. Yeah.
My parents, I guess, they raised me up to be a proud Jew, and I think I've maintained that. Probably I'm sure there's more I could do. I didn't realize that people shrink away from who they are. Where's the fear of just saying, hey, I am who I am?
So where's the fear? That's a broad question. It's either because we're scared of what's going on, or we're brought up with a little bit of fear when the worst time to you know, to have more fear, and our parents tried to hide it in, you know, in times that we should maybe be hiding. Definitely, right? There's so many different eras. If you speak to Holocaust survivor, you'll see some Holocaust survivors are right. So, but some of them are going to be very open and straight out about their Judaism, and others are going to be very much in hiding, and you can't blame them. So right there you go.
No, I don't blame.
You know, right. So, but at that point over there, you can see maybe their children of Holocaust survivors that were more in hiding are now growing up that way. But we have to realize that, you know, We have to, again, the times have changed. We're in different places, and it's we have to do things a little differently. And, you know, not, God forbid, forget our past. God forbid. But to be able to see that, you know, the world could be different. The world is a better place, and we are trying to make it more and more of a better place. And in truth is, there's so much more light in the world than darkness. It's just that the darkness gets a lot more attention.
Yeah, that's right. It makes the headlines. But, you know, I never thought about the difference, even though my parents survived the Holocaust, and other parents who begat children, of course, they survived the Holocaust, but maybe it was different because I grew up in Israel as opposed to maybe some people who grew up in America, or they grew up in France or in Spain or in South America. I don't know, but I never really contemplated that, I guess because I was more comfortable with what thought I knew, but evidently I was really quite ignorant to not recognize that there are differences between all those places and the comfort zone of all those places, and what you would be living. The living would be different in America than it would be in France or in Argentina or Australia. So fascinating. I didn't think about it. So,
right, no, 100%. I never knew that you grew up in Israel, everyone, you know, your whole surroundings is very Jewish and very open, and you know, you could feel it in the streets. But yeah, in America, you do have, you know, freedom of religion, and we should be able to do it in a more safe and proper way. You remind me of a quick story when I was in Poland.
Really?
Maybe 18 years ago. Yeah. When I was in Poland about 18 years ago, we wanted to try to reach out to different Jewish people still living there from the war, or from right after the war, people that moved back, or people still living there. And we had a list of a few that we're trying to come in contact with. And long story short, we traveled for quite some hours for a name and an address that we had on our list, and we come there, we knock on the door, and it's me and myself and a friend, and we're both, you know, I'm wearing a hat and a jacket, you know, I look like a real Hasidic Jew. We knock on the door, and we hear someone at the door peeking through the peephole. Okay, and then they're not opening, and also we hear like a little knock by the window. The person is motioning to us, go to the back of the house. Don't go, you know, like he's motioning. And finally we come into the house. He closes all the blinds and shades of his house. He was petrified. In one hand, he wanted us to come in. He wanted to meet another Jew. On the other hand, he was so scared to have someone that looks Jewish coming into the house. He's still living in fear.
Yes.
And we're talking to him as best as we can, and we're having different conversations. And at one point, we tell him, you know what? I want to leave you with a mezuzah. A mezuzah is for protection. So I thought two things. Either he's going to tell me, you're crazy.
No.
They're going to put a mezuzah on my door. No way, you know.
Yeah.
But it was the exact opposite effect. He tells me, what?
Really?
You think I don't have a mezuzah? So I tell him with all the respect, I didn't notice any on the doors. So like, you think I don't have one? Go to that china closet. He had a very nice china closet. He said, open the door. So I opened the door of the china closet. I'm looking around on like one of the shelves to see a mezuzah. I was like, no, look at the door. He had one properly installed on the china closet door on the inside. So you see how, you know, again, the proper thing would be in a doorway of how you're walking in. But, you know, for him, that was his mitzvah, the way he did it. And like, I respected him. But he lived through it. He wants to keep to as much as possible that he could keep in Judaism, but his living is such fear. So he didn't just have it in the closet. He properly installed it on his china closet door. So again, yes, to answer your question, it goes back to where we're living, how we're living. And we have to realize that, you know, here in America, we definitely have the freedom is a lot more open, and we have to be able to show that it's not the bad headlines in the news, but it can be, you know, your next door neighbor can be your nicest person. It can be a Jewish neighbor and can all respect each other.
It's very interesting because I remember years ago, I asked my father, who's from Poland, originally was born in Poland, and I said, would you want to go back, you know, to see where you used to live and stuff? He said, absolutely not. He would never even think about it, and he never did. He passed away, and my mother, she was born in Berlin. And I asked her if she would consider going, and she did, and I went with her on this trip. We spent about 3 weeks in Berlin, and I was able to see the grave sites of my relatives who I never met.
Wow.
But it was just very interesting because there was... It is very interesting because I guess one of the fondest memories of the trip was, besides, of course, all the historical, we had gone to where she lived, which was half a block from the synagogue, and the oldest synagogue there. And then there was also a school right across where they lived. And what was fascinating is when we went to the gymnasium, she said she didn't realize how small it is, because when she was younger, she remembered it being bigger because she was just a much shorter person. So, it's very interesting because a lot of Jews have gone back to Germany. I thought it was. I didn't live there, but in a place to go to, it was a fascinating place to go to. But I would never consider living there because of the history. But it was a phenomenally beautiful country. But I don't know how the people are today. You must know, because it was like an insulated situation when I had gone to travel there. So. But some good memories, but very horrendous, times that people had to survive. And so it really is amazing, you know, the amount of capacity, of human capacity to survive. And how should we best handle anti-Semitism, which is seeming to be resurging all around the world, including even here in the United States?
I'll go back to the point.
Is there an answer? It's a tough one.
Not answering the question, but going back to the point of showing who we are in a proper way.
Who you are.
Showing who we are.
Okay.
Right. You know, we have to be a light unto the nations. It's not a bragging point.
Uh-huh.
Hashem gave us the responsibility to be able to show the nations, and that's why God forbid if someone does something wrong, it hurts even more and it's amplified because it's the exact opposite of what one should be doing. But in the same time, we have to go back to our, you know, the difference between Hanukkah and Purim. A lot of us are living like Hanukkah Jews. Yeah, we have nice good deeds that we can do and this, but we're not so called committed to it all away. That's more like the Hanukkah Jew. That Antiochus, I don't care that you're Jewish. I'll keep you alive as long as you don't keep your Shabbos because God created the world in 7 days and He rested and He asked you to keep the Shabbos holy. Keep it because you're tired. Yeah, so don't go to work. Don't go to work on Sunday. You know, he took the Judaism out of it. Purim comes around.
I see.
And, you know, this is another very interesting point. I know we have just a few minutes left.
Yeah.
Purim comes around,
But
here's the interesting. I'll go off for a second. I think I'll answer the question with it. Why is it that we get dressed up on Purim? Why do we all dress up in all different different costumes? We disguise ourselves. So as we mentioned right in the beginning,
I don't know.
Esther means hidden, and God is not mentioned in the Megillah. You know, where was God? He was hiding, right? We're in exile. Where we see terrible things going on. What's going on? So the disguising, one of the reasons of why we disguise ourselves is because unlike Hanukkah, that we had a choice, not every Jew had to be killed. Over here on Purim, Haman didn't differentiate between men, women, children, level of observant. You know, we have different labels these days for different observance of Jewish people. He didn't recognize all that.
Yes.
He recognized one thing. A Jew is a Jew, and the Jew who I want to kill, period. He didn't discriminate. So with that, every single one of us has the obligation of rejoicing this day, rejoicing Purim. A person can't say, I'm not that Jewish. I was born Jewish, but I didn't even have a bar mitzvah or a bat mitzvah. Every single Jewish life was on the line for that day. And miraculously, we're all spared. How were we spared?
Mm-hmm.
Esther, Esther came in and told the king, hey, listen, do you know Haman wants to kill me and my people? And that's when she revealed herself that she's Jewish. So, but before that, she said, everyone has to go in. Everyone has to fast before I go and tell this to the king. She recognized that it's not just about connections. It's not just about a natural cause. This is a higher decree. We have to refine ourselves. We have to refine ourselves. Mm-hmm. And by remembering that we're Jewish, remembering that we have to keep to our Torah and our mitzvot, that's how we help. That's how we bring the special protection from God. By doing it properly, yes, Hashem says, I'm going to protect you. He has to be able to recognize and see us that we're doing the best we can in Yiddishkeit, and not letting our peer pressure get to us. And I didn't finish off with why we disguise ourselves. We disguise ourselves, it says, because every single Jew has to celebrate Purim. What if someone doesn't have enough means to be able to celebrate? What if someone doesn't, is living on bread and water? And he can't have a fest.
Right.
One of the specialties in Judaism is they wanted to kill us. Let's eat, right? We sit down after it's all said and done, we have to have a lavish. We have to have a beautiful feast, and it's required. It's one of the four mitzvot for Purim to have a beautiful feast. What if someone can't afford it? Especially today we see it a lot. There's so much going on with people not be able to, things are more expensive. And what if someone can't afford it?
Mm-hmm.
The Megillah tells us that it's about disguising. Everyone got dressed up. So you're getting dressed up, you go into your neighbor, you go by to your neighbor, and your neighbor, it was like a very big open party that everyone get dressed up and everyone can come into crash anyone's party and be able to celebrate with them without being shameful or embarrassed. So that's one of the one of the reasons why we dress up, not to have the shame, embarrassed. Everyone is we're all the same. No one knows, and every single person can celebrate, no matter how much you have or you don't have.
I love that. That's really. I'm glad that you explained that. That's beautiful. Well, unfortunately, we don't have any more time, about 30 seconds left. I want to thank you, Rabbi Mindy Hurwitz. What's the name of the synagogue that you have on North Broadway in Yonkers?
It's the Chabad of Yonkers, the Chabad Jewish Center of Yonkers,
right.
Also known as the Greystone Jewish Center. It's on 600 North Broadway.
Yes. Perfect. Well, thank you very, very much. Thanks for making the time. I'm honored by your attendance. Be well.
You're very welcome. And we invite everyone to come over and enjoy with us. Thank you.
Thank you. Be well. Bye.
Okay, bye.
There we have it, folks. We'll speak to you tomorrow. Take care. Goodbye.